We like to put on lunchtimes like this to help us think through a particular issue regarding the Christian faith. And this lunchtime, we're thinking about science versus God. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Andrew Satch joining us this lunchtime. Some of you might be slightly disappointed to learn there's a different Andrew Satch from the Jonathan Ross saga. but Andrew Satch, more qualified, we hope, to talk to us about science and God. So Andrew's background, natural sciences at Cambridge, then did a PhD up at York, and is now a minister in the Church of England. Just in terms of how we're going to run this lunchtime, Andrew's going to speak to us for about 25 minutes, and then we're going to take questions after that. So hopefully you've got sort of a question slip on your chairs. If questions sort of come up as we're going through, please do jot those down. We'll take a sort of 5 or 10 minute break after Andrew's spoken, gather the questions together, and then we'll spend a good chunk of time running through questions, which will probably take us up to just before 2 o'clock. Please be very relaxed about getting drinks at the bar and picking up food as we start. Over to Andrew.
Thanks very much, David. And thank you very much for coming for this talk on the subject of science and Christianity. And I guess it's been in the news quite a lot recently, partly this year because of Darwin's anniversary, partly last year because of Richard Dawkins' book, partly because of the buses with their There's No God slogan on the side of it. And I guess it's one of those big conflicts of the day, one of those talking points in the office. And I want to ask the question today, does science disprove God? Does science present a barrier to belief in Jesus Christ? And the short answer is going to be no. But I would have said yes. So when I was starting off as a Cambridge undergraduate scientist, I had the idea that science could explain the world, and we didn't need belief in the supernatural. In fact, I expressed my contempt for things like Christian faith in a short poem that I wrote. Now, I should emphasise at this point that I was a science student, not an English student, and that was probably a wise choice. But my poem went like this. Some folk seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. It's quite rude and not very impressive as a piece of literature, but it expressed something of what I thought about the issue. Science explains everything, and surely people who believe in God, well, that's on a par with dropping your money in a well in Cornwall on holiday. It must be that you don't understand anything about biology. I mean, sure, yes, people used to believe in God. They used to believe that the world was flat and that the sun orbited the Earth. But now we've put man in space and we understand all about bacteria and swine flu. By the way, on that topic, I've got hay fever. So if I sneeze, don't panic. We used to believe that, but now surely it's time to cast off those kind of naive ancient beliefs. And grow up. That's certainly what Richard Dawkins argues. He likens belief in God to belief in the tooth fairy and says, okay for children, but for adults we've got to grow out of it. But I want to suggest that there is no conflict actually between science and God. I became a Christian in my first year at university. I met some Christian friends, maybe you have some who've invited you here today, and I was quite impressed by the way that they lived. I was impressed by their lifestyle, their concern for other people, and I was intrigued by what they said was a grounded faith in a God that they had a personal relationship with. It sounded madness to me, but I began to look into it. I was so impressed by them, and in the end, in my first year, I became a Christian. I also stopped writing poetry, so I have nothing to read to you from the other side of the fence. But I was still a scientist. I still carried on with my science studies. And more importantly, many of the people far ahead of me in the scientific world, I subsequently discovered, were scientists. So one of the professors of geology at Cambridge University was a member of our church, and one of the professors of biochemistry. The same year, interestingly, that Richard Dawkins published his book, The God Delusion, Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project, the project responsible for sequencing the entire human DNA, he wrote his book, The Language of God, in which he articulates his belief in the Christian God. And at the same time, a scientist. In fact, And throughout history, some of the leading scientists have been Christians. Maybe you recognise some of these names. Charles Babbage, who invented the first mechanical computer. Louis Pasteur, who discovered the microbe. Isaac Newton, with his work on gravity. Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity. Robert Boyle, who came up with the Boyle's laws that you may have had to learn if you did A-level chemistry. All of them scientists at the same time committed Christians. So where did this idea come from that science and Christianity are somehow implacably opposed to one another? I want to suggest it's not a conflict between the methods and institutions of science per se and Christian belief. It's perfectly possible to be a scientist and to be a Christian, as many people are and have been throughout history. Rather, there is a conflict between two different worldviews and two different ways of looking at the world, two different philosophies, or to put it more provocatively, two different faiths. There is a conflict between the worldview of the Bible, the worldview of Christianity, and the worldview that I'm going to call naturalism, sometimes called materialism. And naturalism is the creed that says that the cosmos is all that there is. All we are is just matter and chance and the fixed laws of physics. So Carl Sagan, the cosmologist, once said in a parody of the Bible statement that God is and was and is to come, Carl Sagan said, no, the cosmos is and was and is to come. That's all. Or Bertrand Russell, the famous British philosopher, once said that mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. That's all that we are. Again, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, every living being was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Not a lot of fun to have at a dinner party, I imagine. But that was his philosophy, that all there is in the world is just the atoms that make us up and the random bumping into one another of those atoms. That's put all of us in a room like this today, listening to me speaking. And that worldview certainly is in conflict with the worldview of the Bible. But I want to suggest that science isn't automatically on naturalism's side. That's the kind of trick that I think Richard Dawkins has played on us, that he wants to set it up as though science automatically supports naturalism. And I would suggest it doesn't. Science is a tool, a method of inquiry for observing the world and trying to explain what we see. You can use science as a tool to investigate these two philosophies. But if you define science naturalistically to start with, you've kind of loaded the dice in your favour before you do the experiment. I'm supposing I was to make a machine to detect visible light. So inside my machine I have a prism to break light into its different wavelengths and a whole series of detectors along the other side of the prism. And I can measure all the different wavelengths of visible light all the way from red through to blue. And you say to me, hey, Andrew, I think I found this thing called infrared light. I think that's how the remote control works when I change the channels on the telly at home. And I say, well, let me have a look. So I point your infrared remote control at my visible light machine. I press the buttons, it registers nothing. And I say, no, you're wrong, infrared light doesn't exist. See, if I set up the machine only to be sensitive to visible light, I can't then use its existence to disprove or argue against the existence of something the machine was never sensitive to measure in the first place. If you're going to decide, when you decide how to do science, that the only explanations that are allowed and for anything are explanations in terms of matter and chance, because that's all, and as soon as someone mentions God, you're going to shake your head, it's not that science has somehow compelled you to atheism, but you've set things up that way to start with. You've biased the experiment. I want to suggest that actually naturalism is a faith position. It's striking, in fact, as you read through Richard Dawkins' book, just how often he says something like, I believe that such and such, and makes an assertion without giving any argument or background for it. So what I want to try and do for the rest of our time today is to compare side by side these two philosophies, the philosophy of naturalism and the philosophy of Christianity, and to try and ask, I think, the responsible scientific question, which is which one makes most sense of the data. So I've told you a little about naturalism. I want to tell you a little bit about Christianity. And what I'm going to do is just to read you a short speech, very short speech, by one of Jesus' followers, the Apostle Paul, in Athens in the first century. Now, Athens was kind of the intellectual capital of the day. It was like the kind of first century Oxbridge or Harvard. And people used to like to stand around debating the latest ideas. And we're told that Paul got speaking to some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Now, I don't know much about Epicureanism, but I looked it up in the dictionary, and apparently the Epicureans believed that the gods were so remote as to play really no role in human affairs. Effectively, the world was down to chance, a random concourse of things, and there was no survival after death. So in some ways, Epicureans were similar to the modern-day naturalists, and Paul is trying to present to them the Christian message, and he says this: "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, doesn't live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, in order that they should seek God, in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. And even as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to change their mind, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, 'We will hear you again about this.'" And it'll be interesting to see whether we get those kind of reactions as well today. Now, let's just compare those side by side. I want to compare them in various different ways. Firstly, to ask about the question of design. Now, everyone agrees that the world looks like it was designed. It doesn't look like an accident. Fred Hoyle, the astrophysicist, once said that the idea of chance coming up with the world that we see around us is a bit like saying that a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and came up with a 747. It just doesn't seem to be an accident. The complexity of this world, the complexity of ourselves and our brains and our bodies as we sit here listening. But according to naturalists like Richard Dawkins, design is an illusion. It's only apparent. So he says this in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Design, he puts it in inverted commas, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. So he's saying that what's put the universe together is actually a blind process that did have no intentions at all. It's just an illusion that it looks that way. But Paul says there is a God who made the world and everything in it. Not only that, he made all mankind. And he determined the places where we should live. There is a God who is behind the world, who designed the world, and who ordered the world. And let's now look at science and say which one makes most sense of the facts. We'll begin at the biggest possible scale, the scale of cosmology. Alan Guth, is the author of The View of Inflation, which is apparently the predominant view of what happened at the very beginning of the Big Bang theory. He explains that in order to have any kind of universe at all of the kind that we live in, the expansion rate of the universe in the very first few milliseconds has got to be exactly right. If the universe expands too quickly, all you would have is hydrogen gas, the smallest possible atoms, separated by millions of miles of space in between every atom. So basically, it's just a very, very spread out gas with all you'd have. On the other hand, if the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it, and the whole thing would clump back on itself. And you get a big bang and a big crunch, a universe, then no universe again, even before you have 1 second on the clock. in order to have any kind of universe like ours that persists for longer than a nanosecond and that has things bigger than hydrogen, things like stars and things, the expansion rate has got to be finely tuned to within 1 part in 10 to the power 70. Which some of you deal with numbers, you know how unlikely that is. If you don't deal with numbers, I'll give you an analogy. If you take some 5-penny pieces and cover the surface of the Earth to a depth of the distance between here and the moon, quite a lot of 5-penny pieces, you paint one of them red, blindfold your girlfriend, your boyfriend, get him to pick one out at random, he gets the right one with the red on it, that's 1 in 10 to the 70. In other words, very, very unlikely. Now, Richard Dawkins knows about that problem of fine-tuning. It's not like I've just kind of made it up as a Christian. That is a known problem in physics. But the naturalist has to say, in one way or the other, it's lucky. And the Christian says, no, this world has been created, designed with a purpose like that. That's the biggest possible scale of cosmology. Let's now zoom in at the smallest scale, not quite the smallest scale, but a very small scale of the inside a human cell. And there you find all kinds of amazing mechanisms of kind of protein signaling and things like that that are, as some biologists have described them, irreducibly complex. What they mean by that is there's machinery within the human cell that only works if several pieces are all there at the same time. And importantly, it's quite difficult to build up in stages. So natural selection, as an explanation for why the world exists, why we exist as complex organisms, says basically every biological change happened in evolution by infinitesimally small stages. So to start with, you don't have an eye straight away. Instead of having an eye, you have a slightly light-sensitive molecule, and that helps you to tell the difference between day and night, and so you can hide away from predators. And a bit better than a slightly light-sensitive molecule is a slightly more light-sensitive molecule, etc. It gradually builds up, and eventually, over millions and millions of mutations, you have an eye. The trouble with these irreducibly complex biological mechanisms is that they can't be built up bit by bit. They give you no survival advantage unless you've got all the pieces in place at the same time. So it's a bit like a mousetrap. A mousetrap only works if you've got, what do you need? A minimum for a mousetrap, you've got to have a bit of cheese, otherwise the mouse isn't interested. You've got to have some kind of snap head off thing to kill the mouse and a spring to power it. If you forget any one of those things, then you've either got an uninterested mouse or a well-fed mouse, but you haven't got a dead mouse. To have a dead mouse, you've got to have those three things at the same time. It's no advantage to you to evolve one of them by itself, just to have a spring lying around. It doesn't catch any mice. And it's the same with that in various biochemical mechanisms. For example, the blood clotting cascade. Now, this is quite a poignant subject actually for us at church, because one of our very good friends is currently in hospital having had a stroke from a blood clot. But it does make you think, doesn't it, just how extraordinary it is that we're not dying all the time from that. Now, very rarely, if you cut your finger, most of the time you'll get a blood clot on the end of your finger, and so you won't bleed to death. If you have no blood clot at all, you're going to die. If you have a blood clot in the wrong place in your body, you might die. In order to get the blood clot in exactly the right place, there are more than 20 proteins signalling whether a blood clot should be formed or not. And one triggers the next, triggers the next, triggers the next, triggers the next. Now, any one of them absent, you bleed to death. All of them present at the same time. Very difficult to understand how that could have come about by accident. But the Christian says, no, it was designed. There is a creator God behind the world. So firstly, the question of design. Secondly, the question of human purpose and intelligence. I just want to say a couple of things about this. Firstly, if the naturalist is right, and all I am is just a collection of atoms and electrons, why should I trust my thoughts to be true? Does that make sense? All my thoughts are accidental chemical interactions. So why should I trust them to be an accurate reflection of the world around me? In particular, why should I trust a random collection of atoms in its belief, my mind's belief, that I'm just a random collection of atoms? So the very intelligibility of the universe is difficult to explain ground up if you start with randomness, and at no point do you put in anything else into the process. But let me ask a question a bit more personally than that. What sense does it make of our lives? And at this point, I want to read to you an excerpt from this book by John Gray. He's a professor of European thought at the LSE. And apparently was Tony Blair's favourite philosopher. If that commends him or not to you, but this is what he says. Basically, John Gray's arguing that we've failed to be consistent with our beliefs in naturalism. He himself isn't a Christian. He goes to some kind of Gaia belief later in the book, but he's arguing that we failed to follow our beliefs due to their logical conclusion, and he's lambasting us for that. He says this. Man must accept that his or her existence is entirely accidental. He must awake out of his dream and discover his total solitude, his fundamental isolation. He must realize that, like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his suffering and his crimes. Just that last part, I think, is very perceptive. A world that is indifferent to your hopes and to your suffering, my suffering, and to our crimes. A universe that is just random cannot be asked the question why. So here's this dear friend of ours from church. He's in hospital at the moment with a stroke, age 29. If you're a naturalist, you cannot even ask why. Now, there is no one behind it. It's just accident. And your suffering is just bad luck, basically. No purpose behind it. But similarly, your crimes. Now, I was talking when I was doing my PhD to one of the professors. I used to get a hard time for being a Christian, as you can imagine, over coffee. And one of the professors, who was quite a good friend of mine, we were chatting, and just one, I'm only going to report to you the conversation where I got my own back. Obviously, there were lots of them that she won, as you can imagine. But there was one conversation. I said to her, look, Kate, I can't understand, if you're right about the universe, why me killing you would be wrong. Now, if I took out a dagger and kind of cut you in half, all I would be doing would be increasing the entropy of the universe by a factor of 2. Yeah, it's just why would that be any different from cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast? You know, just rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. She thought about it for a moment. She said, well, it would be wrong because my mother would be upset with you. That's a good answer. But, you know, we were neuroscientists. I said to her, Kate, what is upset? Upset is just the increase in the concentration of a particular chemical in the random collection of atoms, which is your mum's brain. What does it matter? What's the point in it? What is the significance in anything that we do? Now, I would say at this point, I don't think that is an argument for Christianity being true. There's no reason that the universe should be more interesting or more happy than that. I think it is an argument, though, for naturalism being unlivable. I just want to use it to challenge anybody who's thinking, I'm very happy believing that my life is random. Can I ask you, like as John Gray does, to push that to its logical conclusion and see whether you can live with that through a day? See, I didn't take Christianity seriously, partly because of my smug confidence in atheism. And it was when I began to see just how inhabitable a naturalist universe would be that I at least wanted to take the claims of Jesus seriously. And it doesn't in itself mean that they are true, but it means they're worth investigating. But again, I want to compare that with what the Bible says about human existence. Again, from that speech in Athens, Paul writes, God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. He determined allotted periods, the boundaries of their dwelling place, in order that they should seek God, in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. In other words, the Bible says that the heart of human existence is the purpose that we're made to relate to our God who created us. He made us in order that we should reach out and find him. Now, the thing about science is it's just limited when it comes to personal relationships. It's a perfectly useful tool, but when it comes to getting to know a person, it's out of its depth. So imagine you wanted to get to know me, and all you had to go on was stuff that you could work out by scientific experiment. So you could do some experiments on DNA fingerprinting, you could work out who my parents were. If you DNA fingerprinted everyone else in the world, you could find them. You could do gas chromatography, if you're into that, on the kind of vapour under my arm, and you could tell me what deodorant I use and whether it's working correctly or not. You could look at the fibres on my suit under a scanning electron microscope. You could discover maybe that I've been sitting on the central line, something like that. But that's pretty much all you could find out. You wouldn't be able to find out my name that way. You couldn't tell the things I care about, the things that make me cry. You couldn't tell the people I love, or any of the things that really matter about personal relationship. You'd be in the dark about, not because there's anything wrong with science, it's just it's a limited tool. It's very good at finding out certain things about the world. But the problem is multiplied 100 times when you want to find out about someone that you can't even isolate in your experiment. Now, if God is everywhere, he doesn't have a body, he's not made of matter, how are you supposed to do an experiment on him? How can you exclude him from the universe in order to take a control? How can you relate to him, beginning with you and your test tube? Yeah, obviously you can't. The only way that we can get to know each other is if I decide that I want you to know me, and you decide that you want me to know you, and we start to talk. And the Bible says that that is what God has done. And this is where I'm going to close, the final comparison. Paul says at the end of his speech, he says, in the past, God overlooked people's ignorance about God. But now he commands all people everywhere to change their mind, to turn round, to repent. Because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in justice by a man he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now the claim of the resurrection of Jesus really is at the heart of the Christian claim. It is evidence that there is a God who made us, because who else would have such control over the laws of nature that he could reverse death? It's evidence of a God who made us but wants to know us, because why else would God himself be born as a human being in poverty in a stable in Bethlehem in order to teach us about himself? It's a message about a God who wants to forgive us. For why else would God, visiting the earth, go to die on a Roman cross to pay for our sins? And it's a message of a God who one day will judge us as we give account to him for how we've lived our lives and responded to him. And Paul says of this he's given assurance by raising him from the dead. Now, you could translate it, of this he's given proof, or of this he's given evidence. Now, I think that is a striking place to end, because Richard Dawkins wants to set up a dichotomy between faith, as he calls it, and science. And the idea is that science is about evidence and it gets results, whereas faith is something that you do when you don't have any evidence and you just want some kind of wishful thinking idea. You close your eyes and make a jump in the dark. I just want to say that the Bible doesn't recognize that distinction. According to Paul, God is in the business of giving us evidence or assurance for things that we believe. And at the heart of that is the resurrection of the dead. Now, this is where Richard Dawkins' book is at its most disappointing, I think. Terry Eagleton, I don't want to be with this read about it myself, but I'll quote somebody else who's read about it. Terry Eagleton, the professor of English at Manchester University, said about this book in the London Review of Books, he says, imagine someone holding forth on biology whose only knowledge of the subject comes from the Book of British Birds, and you have some idea of what it sounds like to listen to Richard Dawkins on theology. Okay, he doesn't like the book. But the interesting thing is what he goes on to say. He goes on to say, I think the reason is that Richard Dawkins hasn't bothered to do his homework when it comes to the Bible because of his contemptuous dismissal of it. You know, if you're that sure that it's rubbish because of your faith in naturalism, if you're that close-minded before you start the experiment, you don't really need to look at the evidence very closely. So Richard Dawkins says, for example, no one knows who the four gospel writers were, but they almost certainly never met Jesus personally. The four gospel writers, the four eyewitness biographies of Jesus. It's just wrong. Now, the scholars know that in the second century, Papias writes about the authorship of Mark by Mark, a contemporary of his. Irenaeus writes about the authorship of John by John, and they were recognized as such and carried those names within a few years of the documents being circulated. Everybody who was alive at the time knew that. He says again, the four Gospels that made it into the official canon were chosen more or less arbitrarily out of a great sample of at least a dozen, including the Gospels of Thomas, Peter, Nicodemus, Philip, Bartholomew, and Mary Magdalene. Again, that's just wrong. So in the first century, there were four Gospels. They were written contemporary with Jesus' life, close enough in time to Jesus' life to be eyewitness documents. And then about 100 years later, along came books like the Gospel of Thomas, dated about 140 AD, or the Gospel of Judas, 170 AD. And there are all kinds of kind of apocryphal Gospels, people claiming to be, this is a true story of Jesus. But written a century later, long after any of the eyewitnesses were dead. Now, Richard Dawkins, I don't know whether he knows that, or whether he's just trying to be dismissive in order that no one will look into it. But I want to say that the gospel evidence for Jesus and for the resurrection of Jesus was the thing that convinced me. Not to throw away my thinking and take a leap in the dark, a leap of wishful thinking. It was actually a leap of very reluctant thinking for me. So I was pretty content with the naturalist worldview. Depressing though it was, because it meant I was responsible to nobody. I could live my life as I chose. I had no accountability. I was very unsettled at the possibility that there was a God who'd made me. He'd created the world I lived in. He'd ordered everything about my life and to whom I owed some kind of response. Very uncomfortable. And so very reluctantly, I looked into the evidence for Jesus. But I did find it a compelling thing. And so I went through, at the age of 18, something of a Copernican revolution of my own. I used to think that the world revolved around me, and ideas of religion were useful if they were to serve me. But then I realized that actually I was one revolving around, as the whole universe revolves around, the God who made us. He made us with the purpose of knowing him. He sent his son to save us before his son comes again to judge. And when they heard this, at the resurrection of the dead, some of them scoffed. Others said, we'll hear you again on this. And so I invite your response of one or the other kind. And I think in particular there are some question slips. Is that right?
Yes, question slips on your chairs, people you found on the way. Let's take 5 minutes now. If you've got questions, please scribble them down and then pass them to Andrew and myself. And we'll start going through those in about 5 minutes. But do take the chance to come and grab another drink, put some more food over here if you like. And we'll get back together in about 5 minutes time. Great, well thank you very much indeed for all the questions. We've got a good bunch, so we'll look to make some good progress on them and be finished just before 2 o'clock. So actually there's a bunch of questions on a similar theme. Let me just read these ones out. Please can you give your views on creationism in Genesis versus intelligent design, fossils, dinosaurs, ice age versus Genesis 1? How do I explain this to people who aren't Christians? How do you reconcile evolution and Genesis? So recurring themes there.
Yeah, thank you. Drat. No, I'm joking. I mean, these are very expected questions and very helpful questions. I just want to be quite careful in my answer, though, because Christians do differ on their response to that question. And so if you're looking into this as an unbeliever, just, you know, wanting to look into Christianity, I wouldn't want to present to you one view as the, you know, you have to believe this to be a Christian. Because people who are Christians, who trust in Jesus, who believe that he is Lord, would differ on exactly how they understand the relationship between Genesis and the results of science. And so does that make sense? I don't want to say this is the non-negotiable thing. The non-negotiable things would be that God is the creator of everything, that Jesus Christ, he's sent to earth to save us, that Jesus Christ one day will return to judge the world as proved by his resurrection. Of course I believe that Genesis is true, chapter of the Bible. Let me just tell you what the different options are. So some Christians would believe that when Genesis says that God made the world in 6 days, he's talking about a literal period of 6 times 24 hours long, and that he's perfectly capable of doing that because he's God, so it's not a very difficult thing for him to do, and to create universes like that. But we are therefore mistaken, or most modern science is mistaken, when it thinks that the world is millions of years old. Because if Genesis 1 starts the world, Genesis chapter 1 verse 1, 6 days later, and then you start kind of human life and you've got the whole family tree, you can work out how old it should be. It's about 6,000, 6,500, something like that. And they say, well, look, obviously that's a problem for things like the fossil record and carbon dating. And they would attempt to give different explanations for that. So the fact that there was a flood where God wiped out mankind in judgment in the time of Noah, they say, well, that will account for many kind of sedimentary deposits and some of the kind of things that we've mistakenly interpreted, they would say, as being a very, very old earth. And carbon dating, similarly, they say carbon dating relies on the assumption that there's a certain proportion of carbon 14 in the atmosphere that is kind of exchanged with living carbon in trees. Maybe that proportion changed at some point, perhaps through the flood, and that would kind of put all your results out. So some Christians take that view. I personally don't. other Christians would say, whilst Genesis 1 is true, it's not necessarily the case that a day refers to a 24-hour period. It could be a kind of poetical way of speaking about the ordered way in which God created the universe. And that would allow for the earth being much, much older, maybe the millions of years that we think it is. But the point that Genesis is making is that God designed and created everything that we see. So both groups of Christians are very clear that the world has a designer, a creator, who intentionally ordered the world that we see, but some would think that he did it on a different time scale than others. So that would be some of the options. So things like ice ages, dinosaurs, again, some Christians would say fossils laid down by the flood, dinosaurs wiped out pretty quickly by the flood, etc. Others would say the world's as old as most geologists think that it is. So that's the kind of question. Yes, I think that's it.
Thank you. Is there a problem with how we define science? I.e., is the relentless processing of empirical data as opposed to the inquiry into fundamental causes, universal physical principles, which confuses the debate over God and science?
Thank you. I think that's really helpful that, it is important that we recognise the limitations of science as a tool. It's basically a tool of description and then prediction based on those descriptions. And as such, it can do certain things very well and certain things very badly. I think that is helpful. And I do think it's, as I said, one of the irresponsible kind of sleights of hands of people like Dawkins is to pretend that he's doing science when he's doing philosophy. So when he's asserting his naturalistic beliefs, he asserts them as though science has somehow proved to him that the world is only chance. And of course it hasn't done. So I think that is helpful. However, so some Christians would then say, well, we should just say that science is kind of neutral. It doesn't answer the question either way. And then we can make up what we think. We can decide in the sphere of faith what we want to do, quite separate from the sphere of science. Now, the problem I've got with that kind of goes back to Immanuel Kant, the kind of separation of the world into the definite physical real things and then the kind of spiritual, numinous, lovely things. And they're completely different domains. So science has this factual one, and faith has this kind of floaty emotional one. And the reason I'm unhappy with that is because the Bible makes claims about the physical solid world, as well as about the spiritual world. And Jesus' resurrection wasn't just a lovely idea to inspire people. It's a claim about somebody who was physically dead in a tomb, who people watched being executed, who other people saw alive, and who they saw eat and they touched his physical body. And that's an issue scientifically. Something happened in terms of the laws of physics that God tweaked at that point to enable that to happen. I think that's also important because it means that Christianity is in the realm of the objective. So it's not just a question of, do I want to buy into this with my kind of spiritual side as I go around deciding what to feel? It's also about what do I make of the world in terms of the basic things. Where did I come from? What is my body? What is matter? Why does gravity pull things to the ground? Does gravity pull things to the ground because it just does, or because God designed a force that would do that? Because I just want to say that it's more objective. And I suppose finally, what happened in history is objective. And so if you go back in history to Palestine in the first century, who was this man called Jesus Christ? He convinced an enormous number of people over a few years that he was the God who made the world. And that is an objective question. It's not what would you like it to be or how do you feel about it. It's what happened. Was he a con man? Was he a charlatan? Did he really turn water into wine, or was it some kind of fake? Those kind of questions, which have consequently enormous implications for us.
Great, thank you. What was it that convinced you that there was a God?
It was a combination. It was a combination of a, as I say, it, the thing got me interested with was the lives of Christians I knew, and the way that they lived was very intriguing. I also didn't think it was true just because they were nice, but I thought it was very, you know, what is it that makes these people so attractive? And that got me thinking about it. Then I was I remember being really astonished when they told me that the Bible was, or parts of the Bible were, eyewitness history. Because I'd always thought that the Bible, or you know, Jesus was a kind of stained glass window artist's impression. So the idea that he was a real figure, and the documents about his life and death written by his contemporaries were still available and checkable, I found that very fascinating, and I began to look into it. And to ask the question, things like, you know, how did he convince these people if he was making it up? So, you know, the idea that, ah, maybe they just wanted there to be a new religion, that doesn't make any sense. Now, these people were committed Jews, they were monotheists, they believed that there was one God who was the creator of everything. It was blasphemous that for them to believe that God could be walking around with them, but somehow they were convinced of that. Why were they convinced of that? Were they convinced of this thing by rumours that they didn't check out? No, they were convinced of this by things that they themselves witnessed and saw and have described. So let me read it and work out how this happened. That was partly very compelling. The other thing that was compelling was, again, a reluctant examination of my own worldview. Because I think sometimes what people do is they look at Christianity and say, does it have the kind of 100% proof that I want, without ever examining the ground on which we ourselves are standing at the moment. And when I started to do that, actually with another atheist friend, I began to realise that my life had very unsafe foundations. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't know why intelligent thought was possible. I had no explanation for really anything. I didn't know why it mattered if I got up in the morning or not, or why it made any difference if I were to be a murderer or not, apart from that I'd get in trouble, but ultimately I had no reason. And that really scared me, and I just realised, Andy, you've got to take seriously people who are offering you answers grounded in evidence, when at the moment you have no answers at all. And it was that combination that finally convinced me.
Great, thank you. We'll make this the last question. I'm sorry if you haven't had a chance to look at your question. Andrew will be around at the end if you'd like to come and chat, or sort of push further on some of the questions we've looked at. But here's our question we're going to wrap up with. The buses actually say there probably is no God. If it can't be proved definitively either way, why can't we just sit on the fence?
Thank you. Well, firstly, I think I'd be more confident than the buses. I would say there definitely is a God. So I don't think we both can take refuge in the probably. I think that's, you know, I'm glad that they've been honest about the fact that atheism is very unsure about it, but I want to be more sure about it, and Paul would want to be more sure about it. So he says, God has given assurance or proof to all men by raising him from the dead. So first, I question the premise that it's really as uncertain as that, if you were to look into it. But secondly, why can't we just sit on the fence? Well, because the implications are too huge for that. Now, so supposing you were to go to the doctor and they were to give you some really serious news about your health, and they were to make a very serious diagnosis and say, you need to take this course of treatment starting immediately. And you asked your friend and they said, oh no, I don't think so, I think it's probably just you've got a headache. And you think, well, I don't know, there's a difference of opinion, how can I be sure? The doctor could be wrong, you know, my friend could be right, so I'll just do nothing. Well, by doing nothing, you're not taking the tablets, which is decisively to reject the solution the doctor's and prescribing, and if the doctor's right, you're in enormous trouble. I think it's that kind of situation. Paul is saying that there is a God who made every one of us, to whom we owe our lives, and who, more than that, has intended, the reason he made us was with the intention of us knowing him. And yet we have treated him as if he didn't exist, some of us. I certainly had done. And that's a very, very serious thing to have done. And we've lived our lives without reference to him. And more than that, he's taken the initiative to try and restart a relationship with us, sending his son. And to turn your back on that, to say I'm not interested in you is to face great danger on the judgment day, and isn't a matter of kind of neutrality. There isn't a neutral ground. Now, Jesus, when he said I'm the judge of all the world, is either a liar of kind of desperate proportions, or is telling us something that every one of us needs to take seriously. But the one thing C.S. Lewis said, you know, Christianity can be of ultimate importance, or it can be of no importance. You know, if it's true, it's of ultimate importance. If it's false, it's of no importance. The one thing it cannot be is of moderate importance.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, let me take the opportunity to thank Andrew very much indeed on our behalf. It's been wonderful to see many people here this lunchtime. Can I just ask you to take up the comments slip that hopefully you also found in your chairs on the way in? We'd love to know what you thought of this lunchtime, or maybe other topics that you'd like to think a bit more about at lunchtimes. So please do take those up and jot those in. There might be some who would like to think about other opportunities to hear more about the Christian faith. This is the first event we've got over a fortnight. So we've got a couple of lunchtimes next week, Tuesday lunchtime, Thursday lunchtime at St Helens, and a Wednesday evening at the Glaziers Hall. In each of those opportunities to hear more about the Christian faith, those might be things you'd like to come to. Possibly you'd like to look in even further. We run at St Helens something called a Christianity Explored course, a course over 7 lunchtimes using Mark's Gospel to look into the claims of Jesus Christ. So please do fill out this, pop a comment on there. If you'd like further information, please do tick a box and jot your details down. It's been really good to see you.
Can I just add something as well?
Yeah.
So I just noticed there's a bookstall, which I asked Dave to get and then forgot to mention, which has got some Gospels, which I think are free, aren't they?
Yes.
So they have to be now, don't they? Which are copies of those eyewitness documents about Jesus' life. And if you've never read one as an adult and considered why were these people convinced about this, I would encourage you to do that. There's also a book which I think is the best book on the issue of science and Christianity by a guy called John Lennox, who's a professor in Oxford of maths. Is brilliant as well, and I think that's for a small charge, but that's on the bookstall.
Yes. If you need to head back to this, please do, but if not, please stay around and chat. Andrew will be around for a few minutes as well. Great to see you. Thank you.